content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Shadate Hargett Hill from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Triangle Business Journal. The cover says, "Could this marriage work? Carolina's Healthcare's Gene Woods left and UNC Healthcare's Dr. William Roper are adamant NC will benefit from this giant union. Others are not sure it will." Also, executive voice, from Mertz to Valiant, Bill Humphrey speaks. Real estate, Goldman Sachs drops $103 million with buy. Editor's note, Amazon sweepstakes is well underway. Those are the stories that are on the front page, and we'll get to the cover story. The title, "Is This a Healthy Choice?" On a balmy day in June 2016, Dr. William Roper, CEO of UNC Healthcare System, had an introductory meeting in Charlotte at the office of Gene Woods, the new CEO of Carolina's Healthcare System. Little more than a year later, the pair announced plans to join operations in a massive deal with major implications for healthcare in North Carolina. But as stunning and as sudden as the announcement was, a relationship between the two systems had been established for quite some time. "We have had a branch of our medical school at their main hospital in Charlotte since around 2009, and we have had very friendly relations with them, but mostly it has been just that, friendly relations," says Roper. "Now we've embarked on examining the possibility of creating a new way of coming together." Discussions about joining the two systems' clinical, medical education, and research resources to create new nonprofit healthcare system began in earnest about 3 months ago, according to Roper. And on August 31st, the systems announced they had signed a letter of intent to begin negotiations for what they prefer to call a marriage rather than a merger. The deal includes two of the state's biggest operations. Last year, UNC Healthcare posted a record $3.6 billion in revenue and an operating income of $196.6 million. Carolina's Healthcare posted revenue of $9.8 billion and operating income of $422 million. "It's not a done deal," Roper notes. While there was no getting down on one knee, Roper says the systems have announced their engagement. "There is much detailed work that needs to be done over the coming months," he says, "all leading toward a definitive agreement that would involve our boards allowing us to come together. The UNC and Carolina's combination is painted as a marriage of cost savings at a time when healthcare costs are soaring and the national trend is toward mergers. But the question remains as to who exactly benefits from these cost savings. The hospitals, the communities they serve, or the customers, the patients. And that critical question needs to be answered by Roper and Woods to various stakeholders across North Carolina, including the state lawmakers, before the hospitals are given permission to move ahead. Earlier this summer, news of the UNC and Carolina's combination was closely preceded by a $462.5 million deal struck by Vidient Health and East Carolina University to integrate their physician practices. The CHS-UNC deal simply is in a different class. A joint entity will mean a $13 billion operation with 50 hospitals, more than 4,800 physicians, and 90,000 employees. Beyond that, at stake at North Carolina's access to care and affordability and options as U.S. healthcare spending tops $3 trillion per year, almost 15% of the nation's GDP. If we were to talk to most of citizens in the state, they would tell you that healthcare costs remain too high and still remains a concern for them. That's according to NC Senator Jay Chanhuri of Wake. Over the past two decades, there has been massive consolidation when it comes to healthcare systems, notes NC Senate Jeff Tart from Mecklenburg, who has spent 40 years consulting in the healthcare industry, including in mergers and strategic plans, adding that much of the consolidation is aimed at achieving economies of scale, a term used by CEOs when companies merge to reflect duplication of services, especially in back office operations. As Nicole Dozier, Director of Health Advocacy Project at the NC Justice Center, says, is that saving really going to pass on to consumers? It may not take long to find out, as Roper is seeking a short engagement. The wedding, we think, would be late 2017, early 2018, and then a period of regulatory review, particularly by the Federal Trade Commission, he says. We believe we're looking at the possibility of starting this new endeavor in the summer of 2018, in a little less than a year. Roper is adamant that cost savings and affordable health care are driving the deal. The chief way that the combination will provide more affordable care is to be able to do what we do at a greater scale and produce savings that we can pass on to those who pay for care, insurers, public programs, or patients themselves, he says. Those savings, Roper notes, could come from medical supplies purchasing, as well as integrating investments that UNC and Carolinas have been making separately in areas such as information technology, as well as data and analytics. While neither industry experts nor patients would argue with Roper's assertion that healthcare just costs too much right now, questions remain when it comes to whether cost savings can actually be achieved and whether they'll be passed on to consumers. It's probably true that joining forces roughly 90,000 employees and more than 50 hospitals would aid in negotiating power with vendors, says the Justice Center's Dozier. But then, on the other side of that, I'm not certain that the leveraging of negotiating power, including with insurers, would then be a savings for consumers, she says. Another thing I am concerned with is less competition in the market, as Dozier. It will ultimately be harder for additional players to enter the market, and less competition can mean fewer options and higher costs, Dozier says. One industry research report done by Charles River Associates for the American Hospital Association last year indicates savings are possible. According to the study, mergers decrease costs due to benefits of scale, reduced costs of capital, and clinical standardization. An empirical analysis showed a 2.5% reduction in annual operating expenses at acquired hospitals. Mergers can drive quality benefits from additional volume, standardization of clinical protocols, and from investments to upgrade facilities and services at acquired hospitals. Mergers typically expand the scope of services available to patients. Revenue per patient admission also declines in a statistically significant manner, 3.9%, following a merger, which runs counter to the findings of research linking higher hospital concentration with higher prices paid by insurance plans after some hospital mergers. A key player in how the costs play out is Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, the only insurer once again committed to offering Affordable Care Act plans in all 100 North Carolina counties next year. The company declined to comment on the potential combination with President and CEO Brad Wilson, only saying in a statement, "We look forward to seeing how they will lower healthcare costs so that we can pass those savings on to our customers." UNC Healthcare and Carolinas Healthcare reported revenues of approximately $3.6 billion and $9.8 billion respectively last year. UNC Healthcare currently employs about 30,000 people across the state, with Carolinas Healthcare employing about 60,000. Our plan is to really define our strategy early on, so that over the next 3 years, we can drive those efficiencies and synergies and translate them into affordable health care. Carolinas Woods said the day of the announcement. Rofer says that over the last few weeks, he and Woods, along with board chairs met with senior elected officials for the state, as well as with the Board of Governors of the UNC system. We've had very positive conversations with all those folks, he says, adding that UNC and Carolinas welcome people's scrutiny, though the process and are open to answering questions that may persist. The process will play out over the fall. We're doing our due diligence and agreement to present to our boards, Roper says. Following that, there will be a period of opportunity for the FTC and others to take a look at this. But Tarte says the regulatory process won't happen quickly. It will be a rigorous and thorough process involving state entities and federal entities, he says. As for the potential structure, there's beyond one element of maintaining identities. The two legacy organizations are not going away, Roper says. They will continue to have separate balance sheets and separate debt structures. The medical school, funded by the state, isn't changing its structure and will remain part of UNC Chapel Hill and the UNC system. Tarte says he sees the potential for long-term intent to actually merge the systems. Either way, he says there will be close examination of the business plan and the resulting legal entity. There are a plethora of complex areas to look at, just a few of which include whether there will be one or more provider identification numbers, sorting out physical assets and numbers, management structures, interactions with federal entities like the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, as well as state entities like the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services and Integrative Massive Technology Systems. There is the possibility that down the line there may be the consideration of whether a new entity will become a state entity like UNC or whether North Carolina will let go of the UNC health system. Under this realm, there's also complicated employment issues. For instance, state employee pension plans. In terms of charitable care, Roper says it will remain a focus once a combination is complete. Both UNC and Carolinas are important safety net institutions in our state. Roper says both parties need to work with the General Assembly and the governor when it comes to the future of the Medicaid program in North Carolina. We have important stakes in Medicaid and think Medicaid has an important stake in our two institutions. The combination is not in any way diminishing our service to the underserved, but only enhancing it, he says. The hospitals say a benefit of the union would be better service for rural areas. Together, UNC Healthcare and Carolinas Healthcare say they serve about 50% of patients in the state who visit rural hospitals. But the hospital centers are largely clustered in the metropolitan areas of the Triangle and Charlotte. They do serve other areas. UNC Healthcare, for example, has facilities in several eastern North Carolina counties, but overall do not have hospitals in most of the state's 100 counties. In terms of behavioral health care, more than 40 counties in the state have been found to have a shortage of mental health professionals. That presents an area of potential benefit, Roper says. The first real opportunity is for us to improve in a substantial way access and affordability for health services in rural North Carolina, Roper says. For rural communities, it's about providing care, healthcare jobs, and greater economic value, says Carolinas Woods. Julie Henry, Vice President of Communications at the North Carolina Hospital Association, echoes Woods' sentiment. North Carolina has a rapidly growing population, but most growth is concentrated in major urban cities. That means our rural health care providers are challenged by less economic development, which translates to fewer people with private health insurance, she says. Alliances between health systems offer a way to share the rising cost of caring and maintaining access. It's important to keep in mind issues of network adequacy when it comes to rural areas. Dozier says if people can't continue to see providers they have seen for some time, preventive care could go by the wayside. There is a critical need to make sure that choices is not compromised, she says. This is critical in rural communities where there is already less choice. I certainly applaud the overarching goals of expanding access to rural health care and growing UNC's academic reputation in the medical field, says Chahuri, particularly given the uncertainties when it comes to the Affordable Care Act moving forward. But if the engagement becomes a marriage, she says, the question will be whether the marriage constitutes a monopoly, and as a result, does the monopoly create higher reimbursement rates and ultimately higher health care premiums for consumers in the state? Like Chahuri, the change in the flow of money is what concerns interest groups around the state. If size is going to be used as a leverage to bolster profit and lose statement of the joint entity reimbursement rate, what stops the insurance industry to go right back to the employer or individual and raising premiums? For Woods and Roper, the argument has to be convincing enough to pass the regulatory and the legislative muster. As Dozier puts it, the focus moving forward should be really making sure the consumer is at the center of this. The next article is Executive Voice, Bill Humphreys. He's building a key Valiant unit in Raleigh. Q&A. After departing his post as CEO of Raleigh-based Merck North America late last year for Valiant Pharmaceuticals International, Bill Humphreys is heading up Valiant's newly rebranded dermatology unit, Ortho Dermatologics, in Raleigh. While Valiant's U.S. headquarters is in New Jersey, Humphreys, Executive Vice President and Company Group Chairman at Ortho Dermatologics, is leading a six-person team at the Colonnade One building that is of the former Salix Pharmaceuticals headquarters on Six Forks Road. Valiant acquired Salix for about $11 billion in 2015. Valiant's dermatology unit is part of the company's branded RX segment, which accounted for a little more than $3.1 billion of company's roughly $9.7 billion in revenue last year. In 2015, Valiant saw total revenue of about $10.4 billion and branded RX revenue of close to $3.6 billion. Humphrey says his strategy for Ortho will include delivering its pipeline and managing its portfolio along with channels and distribution as well as access and pricing. When patients get to the pharmacy, he says, we want them to have predictable outcomes. How did you decide to join Valiant? He said, I had the chance to meet with Joe Papa, chairman and CEO of Valiant, last year and hear from him about his goals for rebuilding Valiant and its dermatological business. I learned firsthand about Joe's commitment to dermatology, the patient, and turning the Valiant business around, and I found his vision to be very compelling. Valiant also had a robust dermatology portfolio, an unrivaled pipeline, and great people. What prompted the rebranding of the dermatology unit, and what is its importance to the company overall? This rebranding was an opportunity to change the dialogue. We needed to start reframing the conversation around current and future successes as opposed to prosecuting the past. We believe the name is fitting for our business today because the values prescribed historically by Ortho Dermatologics align closely with Valiant's company pillars of quality healthcare, outcomes, innovation, efficiency, and a continued commitment to our customers and their patients. Ortho Dermatologics is credited with dermatologic innovations, including the Retinoid Revolution, bringing Retin A to the U.S. market and establishing retinoids as the standard of care for the treatment of acne. Historically, Ortho Dermatologics was known for high connectivity and partnership with physicians throughout their entire career and a strong pipeline. We look forward to continuing to build upon this long-standing legacy. Why was Raleigh the right place to build out your team? Before the rebrand, Valiant already had a footprint in the Raleigh area, and given the rich talent base here in the Triangle, it made sense to allocate our dollars toward new products instead of relocation packages. We are making use of how people work today with virtual meetings and electronic communication to maintain a strong presence here in Raleigh and at the corporate headquarters in New Jersey. How has the ramp up of Ortho played out since the beginning of the year? It is a work in process. We established our business and are beginning to turn it around with the launch of Ortho Dermatologics and Silikic, which launched in August. We look forward to continuing the ramp up as our pipeline continues to progress with products like IDP-118 lotion, for which we recently submitted a new drug application to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Additionally, the rebranding efforts also kick off a new creative customer campaign called 1-1 Connections that demonstrates the senior team's deep experience and passion for the dermatology specialty, as well as for the company's renewed commitment to delivery on the core values of trust, access to products, and initiative pipeline. What do you see as the main challenge and opportunities ahead? The challenge is turning around a business in a very fluid environment. There are many moving parts in our medical dermatology business and the marketplace, and keeping our commercial team focused on our products and execution with the customer is paramount. The opportunity is that we get to bring an unparalleled pipeline to fruition and become an unquestioned leader in medical dermatology. Every Friday, I sit back, and whether we move the business a millimeter or 10 yards, I know that we are making forward progress, and that really excites me. The first half of this story is written, and I'm excited to be a part of the team that is actually writing the second part. What are your objectives for the remainder of 2017 and 2018? Now that we have stabilized our business and are focused on connecting again with physicians and serving their patients, we want to continue to address some of the unmet needs around pricing and access and bring innovative products to the market. What do you view as the most important characteristics of a successful leader? Authenticity, selflessness, and humility. I think being a successful leader requires you to establish a connection with the people you are tuned to lead, to be a servant leader and catch people doing things right, and most importantly, treat everyone with respect. In my view, enabling people to own their jobs and to contribute the best of their skill set while making sure that everyone is driving toward the same goal is what makes a leader great. The legacy of a great leader to me is their leadership tree, the ability to attract, retain, develop, and help further the careers and skills of those on their teams. What is your favorite hobby in the Triangle area? Playing tennis. Raleigh has a great tennis community and a number of excellent clubs and courts. Also, my wife and children play, so it is something we can all do together. Moving on to the section on news. Technology. Duke University AI startup secures $10 million. A new Duke University spinoff has raised $10 million by selling its stock. The firm is the brainchild of Lawrence Karen, Vice Provost of Research at Duke. Karen says he's been working on the algorithms backed by tens of millions of dollars in federal grants for decades. The company is, in many ways, the translation of the work we've been doing at Duke for many years on machine learning, he says. The technology has grown to the point where it really is making an impact on the productivity and effectiveness of companies. Therefore, the work needs to be transitioned out of Duke, Karen adds. While researching the technology of Duke, Karen's team partnered with other organizations for test cases. They have a tremendous wealth of data, he says of the company, a Fortune 100 firm that he declined to name. They are engaged in business processes where they're trying to deliver services to clients and they're not learning from their experiences. That's where Karen's research comes in. Work has also been conducted for the Department of Defense and in the area of transportation safety. Over the last few years, the research has become increasingly valuable to the government, he says. So Carrot Capital Partners, Unicorn ML's lead investor, is swooping in to take the firm to the next step. Carrot specializes in building companies from the ground up, says Mike Salvino, operating partner at the investment firm. We feel very comfortable that we can provide the operational financial support, Salvino says. We can recruit a very good CEO to fund the company, and we can help with the making customer introductions, he adds. Carrick has an option to invest an additional $5 million should the board choose to do so. We wanted to make sure this team didn't have to worry about raising capital, Salvino says. Moving on to the next thing on the page, real estate. Goldman Sachs buys 7 buildings near RTP for $103 million. 7 buildings in Morrisville Pyramida Park have sold for $103.2 million to Goldman Sachs. Until last week, when the deal closed, the buildings were owned by a joint venture partnership that bought the 21-building Pyramida Park campus as part of Duke Realty's massive office portfolio sale in 2015. The group included Trinity Capital Advisors, Starwood Capital Group, and Vanderbilt Partners. Trinity Partners, the sister company of Trinity Capital, has managed leasing and operations at Pyramida Park. It is not clear if Trinity will continue managing the Goldman-owned buildings. Representatives from both organizations did not respond. The buildings are located at 1500, 1600, 1700, 1800, 2000, 2250 Pyramida Park Drive and 3800 Paramount Parkway. Based on Triangle Business Journal's quarterly space report, most of the buildings were close to or at full occupancy as of the second quarter of 2017, except the 1800 building, which was 52% vacant. The deal adds nearly 600,000 square feet on 40 acres to Goldman Sachs' commercial real estate portfolio. A review of Wake County real estate records shows the total tax value of the properties is $84 million. The previous owners paid $85.4 million for the buildings in April 2015. Scott Humphrey, Ryan Clutter, and Chris Lingerfeld of HFF represented the seller in the transaction. In the section called Around Estate, major updates. Charlotte Center preps for expansion. Tourism executives outlined their next steps on September 11th to expand the Charlotte Convention Center, setting up a vote later this month that will provide $8.5 million to finish design and prep work. City Council is expected to approve the request at its September 25th meeting. Construction would begin in May 2019 and be finished early in 2021. According to the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority, the $110 million expansion would add 26,000 square feet of smaller meeting rooms and 15,000 square feet to host pre-event receptions. The project also includes a pedestrian bridge over Stonewall Street, linking the convention center with the Westin, the city's primary convention hotel, and Stonewall Station. Crescent Communities expects to open Stonewall Station, which includes 47,000 square foot Whole Foods grocery store and 459 luxury apartments next year. Several council members asked Tom Murray, Visitors Authority CEO, for assurance the project won't exceed its $110 million budget. Randy Harrington, a city government financial executive, told council the existing convention center fund has capacity to pay for the improvements. He also said the city has carved out $110 million and isn't allowing for overruns. Murray pledged to reduce or eliminate features to stay within the designated budget. TV's design and holder, Edison Ford, and construction management firm will handle the remaining design and pre-construction work if council backs the proposal later this month. In early 2019, council will be asked to approve the bulk of the construction budget according to the updated proposal. The convention center opened in 1995. With the additional meeting space, the convention center will triple its meeting capacity. 15 new meeting rooms measuring 1,800 to 2,600 square feet. Each will offer a range of options, including combinations allowing for as much as 10,000 square feet for a large-scale event. The convention center has 278,000 square feet of exhibition space, 50,000 square feet of meeting rooms, and a combination 60,000 square feet divided between two ballrooms. Now we're turning to Viewpoint. Higher education. Campuses shouldn't breed contempt. Republicans and conservatives are growing more doubtful about the notion that higher education is a constructive social institution. According to a new Pew Research Center survey, 56% of Republicans and GOP-leaning independents think that colleges and universities have a negative effect on the country, up from 45% in 2016. Only 19% of the Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents say the same. To these increasingly skeptical right-of-center voters, university leaders and professors may be tempted to say, good riddance. If Republicans are going to spurn universities, some might conclude perhaps universities should spurn Republicans, who obviously have contempt for education, scholarship, and the life of the mind. Of course, that's not really the position of the higher education sector. It can't be, not if it's to survive and thrive. University leaders desperately want to protect their flow of cash and students. They know many donors, parents, politicians, and voters are Republicans and conservatives. The nightmare scenario for university leaders is playing out right now in the Show Me State. In case you're not familiar with the episode, back in 2015, there was a series of campus protests at the University of Missouri when a student journalist attempted to cover one of them. An assistant professor at Mizzou, Melissa Cleek, demanded the journalist leave. "I need some muscle over here," she famously shouted in an attempt to recruit other students to force the journalist away. The result furor made national, even international news. Click was terminated. In alliance with prominent left-wing professors and associations, she unsuccessfully fought her dismissal, arguing in the Washington Post that while her lack of experience had produced a certain clumsiness, "I don't want to live in a world where citizens are too afraid of public scorn to take a chance, do you?" Yes, actually, I want to live in a world where educators would be too afraid ever to consider threatening students with bodily harm. Call me a troglodyte if you must. It turns out that lots of people in Missouri are similarly primitive. Horrified at what the episode said about the campus and disgusted at the feckless leadership that let the protests escalate in the first place into active interference with the rights of other students and the normal operation of a school, parents and donors are voting within their feet. Mizzou's freshman enrollment has dropped 35%. Hundreds of employees have lost their jobs. For a group of people seemingly obsessed with categories and invidious stereotypes, far too many professors traffic in the worst kinds of stereotypes about their critics. There are many North Carolina Republicans and conservatives who possess a value college degrees cherish higher learning and have proudly acquired and applied graduate training to successful careers in business, law, medicine, science, and education. While there have recently been some shifts in partisan allegiances among voters with varying levels of education, the gaps aren't wide. According to a 2016 exit polls, for example, half of North Carolina voters had college degrees. They split their votes for the president between Hillary Clinton, 49%, and Donald Trump, 48%. Even 44% of North Carolinians with graduate degrees picked Trump. Being Republican or conservative, in other words, does not inherently breed a lack of respect for higher education as an institution. So what does? When parents, donors, and taxpayers see conservative speakers on campus shouted down or assaulted, they worry. When they see public universities use a platform for progressive political activism rather than legitimate educational or research activities, they seethe. When they compare the rising cost of college degrees against the value, either in the job market or in the intrinsic world worth of what their children have learned, they recoil. When they see professors deny the legitimate authority of Republican lawmakers and duly appointed boards to provide governance to state agencies, they fume. The message many Republicans and conservatives perceive from higher education sounds something like this. Give us your children, give us your money, then shut up. The answer is no. This viewpoint comes from John Hood, who is the chairman of John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. He can be reached at jhood@johnlocke.org. Tell you a little bit about the list, what's coming up. September 22nd, minority-owned businesses. September 29th, highest paid occupations, foreign-owned companies. October 6th, residential and custom home builders. October 13th, largest privately held entities. Now, we move to next week as well. Executive Voice, Zach Moradis. The aha moment for Zach Moradis came in 2004 when he was an offensive lineman for Duke University. Moradis struggled to manage all of the demands of a college athlete and was tired of running steps at 4 a.m. when he forgot a meeting. Moradis decided if he was having trouble juggling it all, others must be too. So as part of a class, he developed an online platform that would integrate the various demands, and that formed the basis of TeamWorks, a Durham-based company that now services more than 1,000 pro and college clients, including the NCAA. Next week, find out how Moradis built the company and where TeamWorks is headed. Moving on to the business section, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings. Burger joint goes old school and now it's growing. Biz has seen the long lines at Al's Burger Shack in Chapel Hill. So we're well aware that Al's, which opened in 2013, is more than just your regular burger joint. Al's Burger Shack features beef from pasture-fed cattle and sweet potato fries, the New York Times once called irresistible. Now, Al's Burger Shack is expanding with a second location opening September 18th at Southern Village. The new location will have more seating, free parking, and expanding menu, turkey burger, side salad, and beer on tap. Owner Al Bowers, who graduated from UNC Chapel Hill in 1988, yearned for an old school feel. We just do things kind of how they did them 40 or 50 years ago, but with a little more technology, he says, adding that makes the space feel timeless. People like that, I know I do, he says. Indeed, they do. The Franklin Street location has 700 square feet and serves more than 250 people per day. Bowers will have more space in the second location with 1,500 square feet at Southern Village. Bowers says he looked at locations in Durham and Chatham Park, but nothing felt right. His hope now is to get Southern Village off to a great start and then expand even more. Someday, he says, I hope there are a ton of Al's Burger Shacks around, and I'm on a beach somewhere. Another business, smells good. Carrie Bakery cracks into Whole Foods. Carrie's La Farm Bakery will open a new venue inside the Whole Foods Market that is scheduled to open this fall inside the Austin Town Center in Cary. This partnership between La Farm and Whole Food Market marks another exciting moment in America's bread revolution, says La Farm's co-owner, Missy Vatanant. The bakery will manage 1,500 square feet of space inside Whole Foods, featuring a European hearth oven just like the one they used at the original location in downtown Cary. The new location will offer a full section of breads as well as a coffee bar and cafe menu items. We are thrilled to welcome Master Baker Lionel Vatanant and his team at our newest store, says Colleen Conrad, Culinary and Hospitality Director for Whole Foods Market South Region. Game time. Hey, who knew we were that sporty? As Biz keeps being assured that Chuck Greensburg's bid to buy the Carolina Hurricanes Hockey Club is still on track as he finishes lining up a syndicate of local and national investors, here comes a piece of news that may make Greensburg's investors slightly less worried about their investment. Okay, maybe not, but still. Men's Health magazine ranked the sportiest cities in America in the past few days and placed Raleigh third on the list. Only Austin, Texas, and Anchorage, Alaska topped the City of Oaks. To be honest, Biz wondered about the credibility of the list after seeing that Anchorage ranked so high on the list. Bear hunting? Men's Health notes the Canes won the Stanley Cup in 2016 and added, aside from hockey, North Carolina State University provides Raleigh with other competitive teams to root for as well. But Raleigh is far from a bunch of spectators. They're doers. With 6.1 basketball hoops per 10,000 residents, Raleigh has the seventh most basketball hoops per capita in the country. Its 1.9 recreation and senior centers per 20,000 residents is also a top 10 market in the U.S. Doers. Do you hear that, Jeff Bezos and the Amazon team? We're doers. Meanwhile, Charlotte ranks 15th, Greensboro 75th, and Winston-Salem came in at 88th. Weak. Never too early. Target's holiday gift, a job for 100,000 people. Here at Biz, it's never too early to start thinking about the holidays, and apparently Target feels the same way. On September 13th, the Minneapolis-based company said it would hire 100,000 seasonal employees this year, up from 70,000 last year. Target stores across the country will hold hiring events October 13th through 15th, the company says. It's a significant announcement given that big box retailers such as Target have struggled to keep pace with Amazon. But Target says the reason it is staffing up in the rise in online orders makes sense to us, ho ho ho, and pass the credit card. Sub Shop is eyeing the Triangle. A sub shop based in Memphis, Tennessee is looking to break into the Triangle market. Lenny's Grills and Sub, which began in 1998, has grown to about 100 stores. The demographics of the Triangle fit our core customer, says Jennifer Benjamin, Vice President of Franchise and Market Development, especially noting the universities here. She says a recent rebranding, adding salads and emphasizing grill items is helping attract new and younger customers. Lenny's wants to grow 200 stores in 5 years. Franchise fees are $25,000 for a 10-year term, plus 8% for royalties and marketing. Lenny's has two locations in Charlotte and one in Asheville. Light fight. At Lenovo, the force really is with them. Jedis have the Triangle to thank for their newest toy. Chinese electronics maker Lenovo, which has what it calls a dual headquarters in Morrisville, recently teamed up with Disney on Jedi challenges, referred to as the latest innovation in augmented reality gaming. The smartphone-powered AR headset enables Star Wars fans to duel in lightsaber battles, and strategic combat, and it has its roots in the triangle. Jeff Meredith, Senior Vice President and General Manager of Lenovo Consumer PCs and Smart Devices, spearheaded the launch of the product, according to Lenovo, and Meredith is based right here at the Morrisville operation. Augmented reality has always been an important part of Star Wars, and it's exciting to bring these key moments to life by marrying Lenovo technology with Disney's storytelling, he said. On now to technology. Briar Creek location. Infosys taps Raleigh for tech hub. Infosys, an Indian IT firm that has already committed to bringing 2,000 jobs to Wake County by 2021, has picked the legacy at Briar Creek for its new tech hub because of its proximity, to customers, the airport, and the talent pool, says Ravi Kumar, President and Deputy Chief Operating Officer of the firm. Kumar was in town September 12th for the announcement and notes the company has already started hiring in the Triangle. Since pledging to hire 10,000 workers in the United States earlier this year, Infosys has created 1,200 new jobs across the nation. Many of those positions are in North Carolina, though Kumar wouldn't provide a specific breakdown. Kumar says a tech workforce has to be organically built. Infosys' pride point is its tech talent training system, one that in the United States could help the nation close the STEM gap. The U.S. has a great university ecosystem, but very few employers investing into the last mile requirements before you actually become productive in the workforce, he says, noting that his team plans to work with both the universities and the community colleges to develop the Triangle talent pool, and is planning to hire people with diverse backgrounds, not necessarily those with computer science degrees. All successful candidates will need is analytics and aptitude, not a technology background. If Infosys just sourced talent with tech-savvy resumes, there wouldn't be enough hires to meet the needs of the growing operation, he says. So Infosys will leverage its training resources to create its own talent pool, just as it has in its home country, he says. Kumar is intimately familiar with this kind of system. A former nuclear scientist, he has no computer science background. He says the transition was not difficult. Analytical skills are more important than training behind a keyboard because technology firms of the future, such as Infosys, invest so heavily in reskilling, he says. The company was approved for a $1 million incentive from Raleigh to locate within city limits. Group horrified by RDU plan to lease I-4 land. News that Raleigh-Durham International Airport is leasing land along I-40 for development has horrified one of the groups pushing for recreational use of the acreage. Days after RDU released a request for proposals, the Umstead Coalition reacted with a statement on its website asking the airport to rescind the RFP and have a public hearing. Its fear is that RFP is geared toward a quarry pit lease. RDU officials have said a quarry is just one option. And on behalf of the Umstead Coalition, the Southern Environmental Law Center wrote a letter September 12th asking RDU to rescind any decisions made in closed sessions over the past 24 months and accuses the airport's governing authority of violating the state's open meetings law. The airport disputes the allegations. The RFP also disappointed Bill Hallman, North Carolina State Director of the Conservation Fund. In July, Hallman said an informal offer of $6.6 million on behalf of his group to purchase the land. The terms involved expanding 105.5 acres along Crabtree Creek to Umstead Park. By leasing, RDU has another stream of dollars to pour into the improvements, and leasing preserves the flexibility of future options, said RDU spokesman Christy Van Alken. Jobs at stake. Triangle looks to lure new Amazon headquarters. As Amazon unveiled plans to seek out the location for a second North American headquarters, economic developers in the Triangle started preparing their pitch. That's because the project, an investment potential worth $5 billion, means as many as 50,000 jobs for the winning region. I guarantee you, we are working for every opportunity, Governor Roy Cooper said hours after the RFP was released, declining to offer details about the state's pursuit of Amazon, citing confidentiality. Amazon, according to its request for proposals, has an initial square foot requirement of 500,000. Phase two will require a total of about 8 million square feet, mirroring the 40,000 employee Seattle headquarters, which includes 33 buildings and 24 restaurants and cafes. The 5,600 employee SAS Institute headquarters in Cary, at about two dozen buildings, is meager in comparison. We are not as large as market as some of the markets I imagine Amazon will be looking at, Adrian Cole, CEO of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, told a panel crowd September 12th at NC State. We will need to demonstrate we have the ability to recruit talent and grow our talent here. While Amazon hasn't said where it's looking, John Boyd, a site consultant with the Boyd Company of New Jersey, predicts the leading contenders to be Atlanta, Tampa, and South Florida, Austin, Texas, Pittsburgh, the Northeast, such as Boston and Jersey City, and even Toronto. The conventional wisdom is that Raleigh's labor market is a bit small, he says, but he notes those odds are insurmountable. On now to life sciences. Pharma. Swiss Crow adding jobs both in Asia and in Durham. The Triangle is a hotbed of contract research organizations, and Switzerland-based PSI Crow, which opened a Durham office in April 2016, is expanding abroad and locally. Since the beginning of 2017, PSI has looked to Asia-Pacific region in particular to build out a base. It opened an office in Sydney earlier in the year and announced the opening of an office in Seoul, South Korea this week. The company is also eyeing a new outpost in Taiwan. All of our expansions in the Asia-Pacific region has been a natural response to industry needs, said Director of Project Management Anthony Labrizzi. It's an important region for clinical research in terms of new sponsors and clients, he says, as well as patient population. In Durham, PSI is looking to move into a larger office, according to its director of NC operations, Sabine Cora DeWischwist. It employs 27 locally and wants to double that in the next few years. Globally, PSI employs 1,600. Some more stuff in the list. Did you know the American Subcontractors Association of the Carolinas is a two-state chapter under the framework of the American Subcontractors Association National Office in the Washington, D.C. area? Within the framework of ASAC, chartered June 13, 1969, there are approximately 300 member firms and 8 subchapters. Activities in the Carolinas are coordinated through the ASAC office located in Lancaster, South Carolina. Building the Billings. The construction industry has been on a general climb since the Great Recession. Check out the combined gross billings of the 4 highest-ranked firms on the list each of the last 3 years. 2015, $291.5 million. 2016, $386 million. 2017, $418.3 million. Taking on the work. In its latest list of the Triangle's largest general contracting firms that published in mid-April, Triangle Business Journal asked the firms to provide the percentage of work that each subcontracts out. 86.7%, the average percentage among the top 25. High percentage, 100, reported by four firms, Whiting Turner, Northwood Raven, Gilbon, Northview Construction. Lowest percentage, 50, reported by Carolina Restoration Services of North Carolina. By the numbers, 13, the number of firms that are either headquartered in or have a significant triangle presence in Raleigh. 2, the number of firms on the list that reported more than $100 million in 2016 triangle gross billings. And last story in life sciences is a done deal. PRA completes acquisition. Raleigh-based contract research organization PRA Health Sciences has completed its acquisition of Pennsylvania-based data and analytic company Symphony Health, a deal valued at $530 million or more. Under the merger agreement, PRA may be required to make additional payments to the prior equity holders of Symphony Health pursuant to an earn-out provision that is based on Symphony Health exceeding financial targets for the 12-month periods ending December 2017 and December 2018, PRA stated September 11th in a SEC filing. PRA's data pickup comes at a time when major players within the increasingly competitive contract research space have been looking to differentiate and add market share as a result. Symphony is a leading provider of integrated health data and analytics. It is generally viewed as the closest competitor to IMS Health, which combined with Quintiles last year. William Blair analyst John Kroger said in a recent research note, "Thus, we view the deal as another strong vote that data and analytics are becoming critical tools to improve clinical trial efficiency, particularly from a management team that has been building a data platform for about 10 years, he added. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Shadate Hargett Hill, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please contact us at 919-832-5138. See you next time on the radio.